This is United States, 76038. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please tell the clerk how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
Yes. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Thank you. May it please the court, Kristen Thayer on behalf of Appellant Jibran Figueroa Beltran. I'd like to reserve my rebuttal time. Thank you, Your Honor. The certified questions that the Ninth Circuit has asked this court to answer center on whether the Controlled Substance Act, the aspect of this drug statute, is divisible. The government would ask this court to hold that when the pharmacy board is scheduling drugs in the Nevada Administrative Code, it is listing alternative elements to Nevada's drug offenses. But that runs headlong into this court's separation of powers doctrine, which is actually the enumerated separation of powers doctrine in the Nevada Constitution. It's a strong doctrine as recognized by this court and guarded by this court in numerous en banc decisions, which include Sheriff versus Luckman, which is the most on-point case to the certified questions. In Luckman, the question posed was whether when the pharmacy board is defining the elements of the drug offenses, including 337, when it is scheduling drugs in the administrative code. And this court said no. The pharmacy board is merely acting as a fact finder. It's not legislating. And so therefore, it's not defining the criminal conduct at issue. The legislature already defined that in the statutes. But if under the government's ruling, the reasoning in Luckman would be severely undermined, and there would now be a question of whether that delegation is actually constitutional. Because if the pharmacy board's list of schedules in the administrative code are alternative elements, then the pharmacy board is legislating. They are now providing alternative elements in addition to what is in the drug statutes, the criminal code. And that is not a permissible, that is a ruling that would implicate whether this was a constitutional delegation. It would undermine Luckman's reasoning and open up litigation for current state litigants and those seeking post-conviction relief, whether their drug convictions can now stand because they might have been, there was an unconstitutional delegation of the right to set the elements of their drug offenses.
So, Ms. Thayer, I have a question.
Yes.
With regard to the question being about this divisibility concept, which appears to be a federal law concept, really foreign, at least to me, and I question what our role is in deciding divisibility, which is a federal law concept, not a state law concept.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely, and that's why the beginning of our brief was devoted to explaining that this is a federal analysis. And actually, as Judge Bybee recognized in a partial dissent concurrence in the Martinez-Lopez decision about California's drug statutes, which the government relies on, Judge Bybee recognized that this is a federal doctrine. It's unique, it's somewhat artificial, because it looks at charging practices instead of just the state of the law and the statutes and case law. And therefore, there really isn't a state analog to this. This isn't an analysis that comes up through this court's state jurisprudence in live controversies with state criminal defendants. It really is just it's a construct created by the United States Supreme Court to keep the facts out of the analysis to determine whether sentencing enhancement should apply.
Well, since the Ninth Circuit has sent it to us, shouldn't we address it, though, because it is an issue of Nevada law? They're asking an interpretation of Luckman, and I'd like you to comment on Mueller versus Sheriff and Andrews versus State as well, that what your thoughts are on that.
Yes, Your Honor. I do think this court has discretion, of course, to accept certified questions. I would just note that from a federal perspective, it doesn't quite fit with all of the case law we've analyzed in your state, in the state jurisprudence. So there is that tension there. And that would, and because there is an answer for the Ninth Circuit, they can follow the Mathis steps. They don't need to certify questions to this court that aren't really decided by current state law. It may never be because it just doesn't come up in state cases. But I understand that is the discretion of the court.
Well,
so I'll turn to the certified
could
question.
Could we rewrite the question and simply answer whether or not the statute, insofar as it refers to a controlled substance, is referring to an element of the crime or a means of its commission, and then let the federal court do with that decision as it sees fit?
Yes, yes, this court can rewrite the question, and I think that is what the parties were attempting to
do. So that leads to my question. Does this statute, do we interpret this statute and its language with respect to controlled substances to be an element of the crime of 453337, and if so, why? I don't think Luckman has anything to do with it. The fact that the pharmacy board picks and chooses between controlled substances is not really informative, to me at least, of the question whether this statute requires the state to show in the state court what type of controlled substance was used in connection with this violation.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's, so I would turn to the plain language of this statute.
That's
indicates there are three there are three elements. It would be the possession with the proper intent to sell, and then the controlled substance offense element. And the statute itself provides no indication that there's actual alternative elements in there.
You have to show a particularized controlled substance or simply any controlled substance, or is that even an element?
Well, I think that the use of the word any under this court's case law means it is ambiguous, so the question here was whether it's the one or the many. That use of the word any, it's not a precise way to describe a crime, as this court has told the legislature, relying on U.S. Supreme Court that said the same in the Castaneda en banc decision. So yes, it is ambiguous, and that implicates lenity, because using all of the constitutional canon, or all of the canons of construction available to this court, as outlined in the brief in detail, you cannot determine what the legislature's intent was as to elements or means. And therefore, lenity is implicated in this case, which would mean it's not an element, it's a means. And Mr. Figueroa-Beltran would prevail. And that brings me to Justice Gibbons' question about the Mueller and Andrews unit of prosecution analysis. So the Ninth Circuit perceived conflict between Luckman and Mueller, but I would submit there is not conflict, because Mueller was addressing the unit of, although it was summary, it appears to be addressing the unit of prosecution for a different statute, the sales statute in Nevada. And unit of prosecution, it's unclear, under this court's case law, it doesn't appear that unit of prosecution is actually getting to the element means analysis that is certified here. Notably, Andrews and Castaneda, the two main cases the parties address, does not use the word elements. It's just not the analysis for unit of prosecution. It's does this statute apply to a given set of conduct in the case in a certain manner? How can it be charged? How many convictions can prevail, given the legislative intent of the statute? We're actually missing the course of conduct here to conduct that unit of prosecution test, even if it were instructive to its elements and means. We don't have a course of conduct here that has been divvied up into multiple offenses that the defendant is challenging. Hey, I actually should only have one conviction here.
Right. And even if we were to determine what the appropriate unit of prosecution is under the statute, does that even answer the question?
It's unclear, Your Honor. And that's where I think that really looking carefully at what Castaneda said and then Andrews coming after that about unit of prosecution, it doesn't indicate that that's actually the analysis that's occurring. Castaneda made very clear that unit of prosecution is not a double jeopardy analysis. Double jeopardy does look at elements, the elements of two different statutes, to see if they match or they don't. That could potentially be, if there were a double jeopardy issue implicated in this case, that could be instructive. Unit of prosecution is something different than that, that does not implicate elements or means. It rather turns on how a statute applies to a given course of conduct.
And then that brings me full circle to the Mathis problem, which is NRAP 5 says, we may answer certified questions that may be determinative of the outcome of a case pending in federal court. And I look at Mathis and the two cases that preceded it, and it's not clear to me that anything we say will determine the answer, because Mathis seems to say if you're not out of it in step one where it's a perfect match, you get into step two, and then failing definitive guidance in step two, you're in step three, and the default would go to the defendant. I mean, I don't see how what we say would be definitive under Mathis.
I don't think it would, Your Honor, because, again, the Mathis inquiry presupposes that there might be some questions that are not answered by the current state of any given state's law.
Is there any other circuit that has certified a question like this to the state court?
After this case, this was the very first instance of it, as we can tell. After this certification, there were two certifications where the parties agreed to it. One was to Oregon, I believe Ninth Circuit to Oregon, and that case ended up being mooted for different reasons. And then one was, I believe, the Seventh Circuit to Illinois Supreme Court, and both parties requested it, and it seemed to be agreeable to everyone to have the state court decide the issue.
And on mootness, what is the status of your client's supervision at this point?
He was released, served his sentence and deported in June of 2018. That started his 3-year term of supervised release.
Okay, so he would still be on supervised release?
He is on, yes, it's not told. It runs while he is.
Is he in Mexico doing the supervision, or how is that being done?
The way it works for these for illegal reentry clients is that, yes, once they're deported, it doesn't affect that the supervision is still running. It's just basically their condition is to stay outside.
That's to stay out of the country.
Yes, and then there could be more violations if they were to return, and that's happened in cases with supervised release violations, but that's how it works, practically speaking.
In preparing for this case, I've been thinking of scenarios, you know, the potential charges, and I don't know if they apply or not apply. I'm trying to apply this test here, but let's say in Nevada you have a state offense. Somebody possesses with intent to sell, let's say, heroin and methamphetamine, and transfers them in the same transaction to the buyer of it, though, like that. Is that two offenses or one offense because it's one transaction?
I think that would be the unit prosecution question, and under doing the full statutory construction of 337 here, we can't be clear what the legislative intent is, which is different than the Andrews case where there was clear legislative intent. So under Castaneda, that would mean that the rule of lenity requires that it be treated as one offense because the legislature didn't make it clear.
Andrews came out exact opposite, right?
Yes.
Right? I mean, because I dissented in Andrews.
Yes.
And Andrews was in Castaneda, any was a problem, and in Andrews, any was not.
Yes.
Right? Do you agree that it's well, strike that. Do the jurors have to agree on which Schedule One drug, which controlled substance, to maintain a conviction? So if six jurors think it was heroin and six jurors think it was cocaine, we say both are Schedule One drugs, do they agree like that? Then is that sufficient to prove that the defendant sold a controlled substance if they don't agree upon the particular drug?
Yes, Your Honor, because under the Luckman reading and for the many reasons of the brief, the identity of the substance isn't the element. It's just any controlled substance scheduled in one or two or the enumerated offenses of GHB in the text of the statute. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Nancy Olson, appearing for the United States. May it please the Court. I'd like to start out with the questions as presented by the Ninth Circuit. Justice Kadish asked about divisibility. I just want to make clear that it's our position that this court doesn't need to touch divisibility. The reason why the Ninth Circuit sent this question here in the first place is because it found an area of state law where it was not able to determine the answer based on current decisions from this court. And so to Justice Hardesty's point, you can, in fact, rewrite the question however this court sees best fit. And we tried to do that a little bit in our brief by saying what the Ninth Circuit really needs to know here is what are the elements of this offense. And in particular, does the jury have to agree on the type of drug? Can they be charged in multiple counts, one count, and so on? So I think the place that we need to start here is the same analysis that this court used in Andrews. Even though that was a panel opinion, it used a non-controversial approach to, of course, starting with the text. If that's not clear, turning to the legislative history, and then finally, if need be, looking to some other decisions from this court or other courts that were dealing with the same issue. So we don't disagree that because we have the word any controlled substance in the statute, it does present the same ambiguity question as the court noticed in Andrews, but we want to urge the court to apply that same analysis and see what else we can determine from Nevada's Controlled Substance Act to see if this is an element or not. So the first place that Andrews started was to see if there were any helpful statutes in the USDA that were cross-referencing over to 453337. And there it found a couple and said that they refer to a controlled substance or the controlled substance in the singular. And so we had the same thing with regard to this possession with intent statute. We gave several examples in our brief, but I'll just focus on a couple of them today. For example, the forfeiture statute, under subsection 9, if you're going to forfeit anything of value that was part and parcel of a possession with intent offense, it applies to, quote, anything in exchange for a controlled substance. And also later in that same subsection, there's a rebuttable presumption, which actually a panel of this court considered on Friday afternoon, whether if cash is over $300, it would be assumed that it had to do with that drug transaction. And it also refers to the singular, an exchange for a controlled substance. We also have a statute 453570 that talks about the amount of a controlled substance that's needed to prove any controlled substance offense under the Uniform Act, including this one. And it also refers to identification as a controlled substance.
But doesn't that argument cut kind of against you that they used any controlled substance in the statute under discussion here, whereas they use a elsewhere?
I don't think it does, Justice Pickering, because in the statute, the one I just referenced, it includes all of the USDA provisions. And so it's using a in the singular, talking about, for example, proving the type of controlled substance, seeing if something needs to be forfeited, seeing if there would be civil penalties coming alongside with it. And so as this court did, and Andrews looked at the USDA broadly and said, almost every single reference is to singular, A or the, and there's just four statutes that don't have it. That would be the two trafficking statutes that were considered in Andrews and the two possession with intent statutes.
But in this statute, they deviated from the model from which it was drawn to change A to NA, did they not?
The model USCA statute has a lot of differences from Nevada law, and that includes things like possess, deliver, sell, traffic, so there's one sort of...
Right, but on this particular language, yes. It changed from A to any.
From A to any, and so that's why we looked, as the Andrews Court did, at the statutory scheme. The other thing that this court says over and over again is within a greater statutory scheme as well as within one statute in that scheme, the court tries to read those harmoniously because the court doesn't want to create something that would become unreasonable or an absurd result. And so if we read them differently in this case, what we would have is in trafficking, that the state would prove drug by drug each possession of a quantity, and then in possession with intent, the state would just prove one possession without regard to the type of drug or the quantity. And just a word on the institutional concerns in this case. The federal government is not urging this position in a vacuum. This is not the court that we normally practice in. This is not the statutes that we normally prosecute, of course. We consulted with the DA's office here in Las Vegas as well as in Washoe County to ask them, what do you have to prove? Because, frankly, it's not super clear. There's no model jury instructions in the state. And we didn't. We had Mueller. Admittedly, Mueller is kind of old. Mueller deals with the sales statute. So while we thought Mueller was pretty instructive, we also didn't want to come in here and create some sort of a problem for all the state prosecutors in Nevada and have them facing something that they didn't intend. So that information that we got, which we tried to illustrate a little bit through the documents in our motion for judicial notice, is to show how they are doing it, in fact, in these possession with intent cases. So those are one example where the case went to trial, multiple counts, I think it was four or five, each substance alleged and proven separately, a verdict formed, the jury has to agree drug by drug if that possession in fact occurred. And then as well, there was a case where it was a guilty plea agreement, started out with two counts, two separate drugs, and then the guilty plea agreement had the defendant pleading to only one of those counts. And so in taking this position here and asking this court to weigh in on the elements of this statute to assist the Ninth Circuit, we were trying to remain consistent with what was actually going on in Nevada. But because there is, we have Mueller on the sales statute, we now have Andrews on the trafficking statute, but admittedly there's not a decision from this court on the possession with intent statute. So I think that's where the assistance to the Ninth Circuit comes in, by filling that small particular gap and nothing more regarding federal divisibility or anything of that nature.
So our decision in Andrews, unit of prosecution, on another statute contained within the Uniform Controlled Substance Act as well under Nevada law. But even if we address what's the unit of prosecution under this statute, similar to whether we do the same thing, but similar analysis to what we did in Andrews, does that even answer the question?
It does, Your Honor. And if you look at what the way that the court considered the question in Mueller, it's really two sides of the same coin, because one question is, what is the unit of prosecution? How many different counts do we need to have in order to bring these multiple charges? But once you know what the unit of prosecution is, it also tells you that there's something from one count to the next count that you're going to have to prove differently to sustain two counts. And the only thing that can be different from one trafficking count to another trafficking count, or likewise here, one possession with intent count to another possession with intent count, is the type of drug. So if the unit of prosecution is each individual substance, that would answer the question for the Ninth Circuit, because if I have count one heroin and count two methamphetamine, in order to prove those to the jury, I'm proving what type of drug it is, meaning jury necessarily has to find and agree, and then meaning the ultimate conclusion is that it's an element. So we think that those two questions, one flows into the other, and it would answer the ultimate question for the Ninth Circuit. What they're really getting at is the type of drug, an element, does it have to be proven to sustain a conviction in any possession with intent case? And there was a question raised earlier about potential mootness. I just want to point out, with regard to cases outside of Mr. Figueroa-Beltran's case, this issue comes up all the time, not just in this divisibility analysis under the sentencing context, or perhaps under a federal guideline that has since been repealed. There are other federal sentencing guidelines that raise a similar question of a, quote, controlled substance offense. And so what the federal courts are doing is trying to decide if something like Nevada possession with intent counts as a drug offense. But in order to do that, they're looking straight at the elements. As Ms. Thayer said, they try to avoid looking at the facts, and that's right. But in order to look at the elements, they just need to know what those are, and then they can proceed doing their whole federal divisibility analysis on the side.
Ms. Olson,
yes.
Do you think you can reconcile Castaneda and Andrews?
Yes, I think
use
so.
Of any? How is it in pornography, it's one possession, there are all these things, but when we say any in the context of drugs, then it must mean each individual drug. How do you reconcile those two decisions?
In Castaneda, the court looked at what bad conduct the legislature was trying to avoid. And there it was just possession of any type of images, video, et cetera, child pornography. So they said a possession is a possession, and it's whatever you have when we come do a search warrant. We grab your computer, you have 50 images, that's your possession, and that taking that away and charging you once will achieve the goals of that statute. The difference here is if you look at the legislative history of this possession with intent statute, and we cited this in our brief, what the legislature was trying to combat was proliferation of dangerous drugs, and not just one type, but all types. And I just want to point...
But if that were the case, I mean, to me, the rule of lenity is getting understated in Castaneda in your description, but in Andrews, it's puzzling that, I mean, it was the defendant in Andrews who wanted the two separate drugs to be two separate crimes because they took him under the amount that you needed, and I forget, 9 grams or something of heroin, and it jacked up the seriousness
right.
of the offense if it was two separate crimes. So arguably, the rule of lenity came out the same in both because it favored him. This Nevada legislature is writing statutes that are ambiguous to somebody trying to measure the legality and consequences of an infraction of their conduct. And that's a pretty fundamental requirement for a criminal statute. And it's of concern to me that, we parse between that. I kind of join her question on to what extent does the rule of lenity apply here?
It's interesting because this came over from federal court, but I think it kind of cuts in the same way because the position we're taking is the state has to prove more to get more counts. And by prove more, I mean they have to prove another type of drug. And so it's holding the state to beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof in order to get a count under the statute. And so it seems to me the rule of lenity would be more of an issue if you're talking about
well, I can just allege five substances and I don't really have to prove maybe one or the other, and the jury can kind of just see how they feel about it. So it seems to me the stricter burden on the state would be holding this to be an element, therefore making sure that the jury finds it and agrees upon it before any conviction can lie.
Because with the possession of intent, it's so different from a trafficking statute as well. As far as if you want to charge two counts, you have to have two different drugs.
That's correct.
You can't even have two counts unless you have the two different drugs, basically. Otherwise, you would, yes, you could. But, I mean, in order to get more than one count, unlike trafficking, what they asked in Andrews.
That's right. So if you have the possession with intent and trafficking both start from the place of possession, but then they diverge in one, you have to prove quantity, and one, you have to prove intent that they had a quantity that they hoped to sell.
Could you address the separation of powers point that your opposing colleague makes?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at, let me just refer to the case name here, the Berkson case and the Hardy case that Ms. Thayer cited. Even though the United States Constitution does not have an express separation of powers provision written in, the Supreme Court of the United States has made express what that Constitution leaves implicit. And so even though Nevada wrote it down explicitly, the way that the federal Constitution is interpreted is exactly the same way. We don't think there's a material distinction. If you look at the footnote in Berkson, it mentions in a footnote in passing this idea that Nevada embraces it more. And so if we can say that the fact that they wrote it down explicitly embraces it more, I wouldn't disagree with that. But if you look at the case that Berkson is relying on, which is Hardy, it basically comes out and says that Nevada's separation of powers is the same as the federal separation of powers. It's just that one was written down to begin with, one was implied to begin with, and then the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, made that explicit. So we don't see that.
So you think it's okay for the administrative agency in Nevada, despite our explicit constitutional separation of powers clause, to be saying, oh, we're going to add this to the list of, as a new offense, this drug being possessed, even though the legislature never specified it?
Yes, Your Honor. Even though the legislature cannot delegate its ultimate power to legislate, what it can do is delegate certain aspects of that to regulate and to keep things updated in the case of these drug schedules. And so I'll note for the court that the USCA is based on the Federal Controlled Substances Act, and the delegation provision comes straight out of that. I believe it's Section 201 of the USCA. And Nevada.
But if federal and Nevada are coextensive, we don't
yes.
have an issue. If our separation of powers is more robust, and our case, Lutman or whatever it is, seems to suggest that it is, then it becomes more problematic.
I think if you read Lutman, it does not suggest that it's more robust. And the way that we can tell this, if you look at the decisions that follow, there's two that are particularly helpful. McNeil relied on Lutman and said it didn't come out and say these aren't elements and therefore what we did in Lutman was okay. What it said was this is a permissible constitutional delegation because, one, there was a specific delegation of authority, so the board knew what it was supposed to be doing, and two, there were specific guidelines given by the legislature, so the board could stay within those parameters. So whether it's federal or state constitution, the only time that such delegation is permissible is when the guidelines are set and when there's an express delegation of authority. But we don't think that Lutman has anything to do with this court looking at and answering the elements. It's just talking about the permissible delegation of authority there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points for rebuttal. First, the rule of lenity applied here would mean that there'd be one conviction for the one act of possession of multiple substances. That's how lenity works. Lenity doesn't mean that there's a higher proof for the government. It's from the perspective of the defendant, whether they are convicted of multiple offenses or one offense. So I just wanted to clarify that that is how the rule of lenity would apply in this case, just as it did in Castaneda. And as the courts recognize, Andrews was slightly different because lenity actually worked in the defendant's favor to have multiple offenses that lowered his penalty for those multiple offenses. Two, turning to the separation of powers arguments, this court has stated en banc time and time again
that the separation of powers in Nevada is stronger than in the federal context. Berkson v. Lapone explains that this court was not going to follow a U.S. Supreme Court case because the Nevada Constitution embraces separation of powers to an even greater extent than the United States Constitution. So the government is incorrect that they are the same protection, but they are the same separation of powers doctrines. They're not under this state's constitution and under this court's en banc precedent. And this means that the way to avoid the constitutional problems in this case is to hold that the identity of these substances, that the pharmacy board listing elements in the schedule, in the administrative code, is not listing alternative elements, but avoids the problem.
I have a question, because when Justice Stiglitz asked about the verdict form, you said it would, and I want to take you back, that if you didn't prove, that all you need to do is prove one of the substances to get, I guess, a conviction under that statute, right, on possession.
Yes.
Am I getting that right?
Yes, if not enough.
But, I mean, in what world does the prosecution, are you saying the prosecution has said to wit, well, let's say cocaine and heroin? Because if they're charging possession with intent to sell two different substances or two different counts, you're going to have heroin in one count, you're going to have cocaine in another, so you would have to prove it as an element of that crime. Because generally, at least in state court, you would charge two counts of possession with intent to sell. You would charge the cocaine and you charge the heroin. So you would have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Both.
If it's an element, which under the unit of if the unit of prosecution answers that question, that's an open question for this court. Is simultaneous possession of two drugs at one time two crimes or one crime?
Well, they could charge it together. They could charge it as long as. But what I'm saying is, on the verdict form, if they have, maybe I'm not getting it. Too hypothetical, but it struck me when you mentioned that there'd be a conviction and they didn't use that particular substance.
And if I may answer,
do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. I think, Your Honor, practically speaking, the parties would request a unanimity instruction, which is, in my understanding, it's discretionary if it's not an element. So to understand to know whether the jury was unanimous as to which drug was possessed, that could be an issue. But again, that's not getting to, that could be a potential practical consideration that would resolve the problem.
But the charging document. That's what's going to rule the verdict, is the charging document at the conclusion.
Yes, and the government could charge in the alternative. For means, if this is a factual means, the government can always charge in the alternative, and that would be acceptable. How you handle that, given the specific facts of the case and the jury instructions, the party's request, I think is different than whether it's an element under the statute and under the separation of powers.
Should the way in which the prosecutors in the Clark County and Washoe County are handling these matters inform our decision here?
So I think that under the federal divisibility analysis, it does inform what federal courts analyze, which makes it somewhat of an artificial analysis. This court doesn't concern itself with charging practices to divine legislative intent, so it wouldn't be relevant, because if all the parties are getting it wrong in a certain area, that doesn't mean they're right, because they're doing it for the longest. It means they haven't captured the legislative intent, and the practice might need to be changed.
Or maybe they're following a unit of prosecution approach.
Perhaps, Your Honor. So really, we ask that the court hold that under Luckman, a separation of powers, it's not an element, it's a means to avoid any constitutional issues in this case. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, this matter will stand submitted. I want to thank both counsel for doing a great job on the briefs and the oral arguments. We really appreciate it. We'll stand in recess for a short time to be back with the third case.